Very kind of you two to ask me to speak to you this evening. This is rather a mammoth task, and I might add, owing to recent illness, all done in the space of a short space of time, a veritable cliffhanger. I was still writing these notes 2 hours ago. UFO hypotheses, 10 years of change. That's the title. We blame Captain Ivan Mackay for that. Had I been able to write to my friend Amy Michel and tell him that I would be giving this talk on this particular topic, I can almost imagine him sort of sitting there, UFO hypothèse, ideas, no good. We don't want ideas. All we want is information, facts, and more facts. That's Amy Michel, the man who thought up the straight line theory. 10 years ago, Waveney Girvan was editor of the Flying Saucer Review. We were very close friends. I'd had a chance meeting with him at the place where I work, and it so happened that we discovered that we travelled on the same railway line every day. So we saw an awful lot of each other, both on trains and elsewhere after that. He was a very fine man, Waveney. Very deep-thinking man. He had views, the same as most people at that time, which he was prepared to state. And this was that UFOs, flying saucers, he preferred to call them flying saucers, were terrestrial or extraterrestrial objects visiting this planet for some reason unknown to us. I had no definite views. I'd been fascinated by reports in 1947, and before that too, the ghost rockets in 1946. I'd also read Kehoe's books and newspaper articles on the subject. I'd read Ruppelt, and from 1955 onwards I'd read Flying Saucer Review, straight from number one. The prevailing idea at the time indeed was that there were extraterrestrial objects visiting this planet, and to me it did not seem unreasonable. Waveney likewise. But of course, old Waveney always kept his cards very close to his chest. And there were many things he thought about that you knew nothing about. And I've discovered, since becoming editor, from remembrances of things that he said, and from odd items of correspondence that have come my way, he certainly was thinking in other directions as well. Before 10 years ago, there had been a few attempts to offer non-extraterrestrial hypothesis, let's call that ETH, shall we? It's rather a mouthful. Explanations. We had the theories of Mead Lane and W. Gordon Allen. And in FSR, in Flying Saucer Review, we've had, among other people, Louis Schoenherr dallying over his extra three-dimensional theories. I remember I being very fascinated by those at the time, especially as Waveney showed me the original texts which I have seen of the same nature many times since, where, although they're written in English, you have to translate them in order to understand what they meant. And dear old Louis Schoenherr was very obsessed at that time with the ideas of a fourth dimension. Again, I can imagine Aimee, in fact I've heard Aimee and his friend Pierre Guérin and one or two others saying, fourth dimension, incomprehensible, impossible, nonsense. Well, UFOs, and the technology which we suppose is associated with them are also incomprehensible to us. It's an incomprehensible phenomenon. So the answer to that one is, so what? 10 years ago, two hypotheses predominant. The first, that they are extraterrestrial visitors. And the second, that they do not exist. Well, how did this come about? I suppose it all started in 1947 with that man Kenneth Arnold and his flying saucer description, and thereupon people said, what are they and from whence do they come? Are they spaceships? And then they are spaceships, just as simply as that. There's no proof at all of this. Authoritatively unconfirmed rumours, but no factual detailed reports of UFOs coming into our atmosphere from space. Mind you, there have been hints of reports from the astronauts and debates and plenty about objects reported to have been photographed by astronauts out in space. But it's doubtful that we'd ever be told if there were such reports. Well, UFOs became popular when somebody called them flying saucers. The so-called ETH was really just a guess, or a series of guesses. But as this guess was made and put abroad, UFOs, the study of UFO reports, acquired an interested following. Well, as I see it, and as all my friends see it, there is no harm in theorizing. If a phenomenon is interesting enough, because it is elusive, as UFOs are, and interesting enough to cause people to theorize about it, then it is all to the good, especially if attractive enough to generate energy in the people who theorize about it, to collect and report and record reports. And after 20 or more years, that, not hypotheses, is our main need in this subject. The most encouraging feature of the past 10 years is that concerted efforts are being made here and there to collect and log detailed information. And also to re-examine many of the old and inadequately examined cases. This is the most important thing that we should do. The spirit of objectivity is on the wing. Even the limited data which we now possess after 24 years since the publicity first given to the subject, even that data is beginning now to lend itself to examination en masse, for comparison of cases with other cases, and for study of patterns of behavior in computerized programs and so on. And this, of course, leads to better hypotheses. The changes during the last 10 years are already widening the scope of investigations and thoughts. 10 years ago, we were nursing a funny subject with a funny name, thanks to the man who first gave it publicity. And because of this, those interested in the subject went on the defensive. In 1953, there were claims made of an alleged landing and of photographs that were taken purportedly of the object which was concerned in the landing, and here, apparently, on the face of it, was support for the ETH. The claimant, some of you must know of him, George Adamski, said that his contacts had told him that they were extraterrestrial. Now, this all sounds very silly, and a charlatan label was attached immediately to Mr. Adamski, and in particular by those adherents to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. You can't win all the time anyway. In the USA, there were two main groups, or, as we've learned since, warring factions. There was the Kehoe group, NICAP, National Investigation Commission of Aerial Phenomena, and there was the Lorenzen group, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, APRO. Kehoe and co. Thought the subject, thought the objects that we see were extraterrestrial. But they would never hear for one moment that they were occupied by anything. Lorenzen and co. definitely thought that these things were extraterrestrial and that they were occupied. Lorenzen and co. were very interested in the humanoid occupants. And in the rest of the world, some people took their sides. Others collected reports and waited to see which way the cat would jump. Well, in 1964, Waveney became ill, and more by luck than judgment, I was asked to stand in as caretaker of FSR. And then, very unhappily, Waveney's illness proved to be malignant, and he died. And fortunately, with the aid of very many, many good friends, I'm still taking care of FSR. In 1964, when this happened to me, I was inclined to look upon it a bit lightheartedly in those days, but it was quite a burden when it landed on the shoulders. And immediately I needed to broaden my knowledge. And the first person I got in touch with, the very first, at that time, is sitting here beside me, Mr. Gordon Crichton. We had many discussions, and in particular, we started theorizing about this subject. We just had to do. I had to widen the scope. I remember having a long discussion with him one day in the lounge of the Norwegian Club on ancient religions and philosophies of beliefs in other levels of existence, other matter, what eventually became known as the parallel universe idea. I don't know if you have seen anything about this. Again, my friends in France were, parallel universes, nonsense. But many ancient religions, including Christianity, if you look at it closely, hold to this idea of a different, in Christianity, down below, a different level of existence. And there was the idea that there was seepage, God knows how, from that level to this. Now, this is all very, very complicated. I don't want to go on more about it, but the thought is that denizens of this other world live here among us, but on a different time basis, and therefore they and we are all passing in between them. But as I said, this is terribly terribly difficult. Well, we weren't the only ones to discuss this possibility. This wasn't a hypothesis, this was purely a discussion of ideas. Elsewhere, there was a man called Alan Greenfield in America who put forward an idea that there were alternate realities from which denizens came through and visited us momentarily and went away. In fact, Jerome Clark, had quite a lively correspondence with me for many years. And he was talking about this idea of Alan Greenfield's, about this alternate reality. And I remember him writing about this and about the fourth dimension idea. The fourth dimension is, if you have a pack of cards in your hand, in the fourth dimension are cards which are nowhere to be seen. You can't see that at all. But the alternate reality is like the back of the card in your hand, if you get what we mean. The parallel universe and alternate reality ideas are attractive and, as I said, complicated, but of course they could explain part of the phenomenon which has appeared with regularity, not only in the last 25 years, but in many years we've discovered in flaps in the past, 100 years ago, 80 years ago, of materialization and dematerialization that are reported by many witnesses. Things which are suddenly here and just as suddenly gone. I expect a large, great number of you, I don't want to bore you, but I expect a great number of you have read all about the case at Balançon from the south of France on the 1st of July, 1965. Monsieur Masse, the witness in that case, said that the object which he had seen and the entities whose influence, he said, had left him immobile, took off with a thump from a central pivot which was stuck in the ground, and six legs which whirled around and stood there motionless, and then slowly floated away for a distance of about 20 meters, and then it wasn't there. Now, one of the investigators who had a lot to do with Monsieur Masse and is still seeing him was Aimé Michel. He waited until the hubbub had died down about this case, and he had long talks with him. And one of the places he used to talk to him was in the gendarmerie, where Monsieur Michel's brother was an officer. This is a very suitable place to make sure you've got a degree of truthfulness, I suppose. And he said to him, "Now, do you mean surely that this object, this egg-shaped object, just went away so fast that the eye couldn't follow it? There it was, and then suddenly gone, like this." And Monsieur Masse protested vehemently about this. He said, "No, it did not. It was there, and then it wasn't there. It's just like this." So this is an instance of the alleged dematerialization, about which we heard an awful lot 10 years or more ago. From parallel universes and alternate realities, it is but a very short step to the world of the elementals. Now again, I imagine a lot of you here know about the case of, as we used to call it, AVB, Antonio Villas Boas, the little Brazilian farmer in the backwoods, 1,000 miles or 1,000 kilometers or more from Rio de Janeiro, who persistently saw strange objects near his field where he was working at night, ploughing. Don't think that's ridiculous. They had one plough, and this capital equipment had to be used to the fullest extent, so his brother ploughed by day and he ploughed by night with a floodlight thing. And Antonio Villas Boas claims that he was apprehended and taken aboard an object, and there was given a rather searching and peculiar medical examination by strange, heavy-suited entities, and was then introduced to another entity who wasn't heavily garmented at all, and who he said, from the deference shown to her by the six who had dealings with him, appeared to be the captain of the ship. Well, I won't enlarge on what went on after that. Suffice it to say that we first heard about this case in 1962, and it was considered rather way out for the review to consider even publishing it. I remember there were plenty of rather coarse jokes about it, about people who were hoping that similar experiences might occur. "Waiting for captain's orders, ma'am." Well, early in 1965, about the time that we were having discussions about all manner of philosophies and beliefs, Gordon brought out the AVB story, plus a lot more about it in Portuguese. He dusted it all off and translated it, thought it might be a good idea if we published it, and had a lot to say about it, because a number of things had happened between 1962 and 1965 which made it feasible to publish this story. And in his discussion of the Antonio Villas-Boas story, some of you may recall that the question of the elementals was raised. He said that we were not to overlook the possibility that abduction and seduction, seduction of the Brazilian farmer, was part and parcel of a nasty game of temptation and deception by denizens of a nether world. And he produced evidence from the 11th and 12th century literature, ecclesiastical literature, of legends of incubi and succubae. These beings, whose offspring from people abducted and seduced, were supposedly witches and demons. Well, that's one way of looking at the AVB story. Another way is to wonder whether or not it could fit cosily into the ETH. On the face of it, it looks rather different from Adamski's story and others that we have read about. But it has been suggested that if indeed these were extraterrestrial beings landing here and doing this to this little Brazilian farmer, goodness knows why they picked him, that they were looking to improve the strain of their race, if indeed there is a race. There could be another explanation to that, but more of that later. So suddenly we find ourselves, about 5 or 6 years ago, 7 years ago, moving a very long way away from the straightforward extraterrestrial hypothesis of reconnaissances and surveillances by beings in things which come and take a quick look and go away. I remember at the time when we published the first edition of The Humanoids, our paperback edition, in October 1966. Soon after that was out, I had a letter from Jacques Vallée. And in this, he said he noted with interest suggestions about the elementals. He hoped, by the way, that too many people wouldn't also take notice of this, because he was doing some research on it. And indeed, quite recently, the results of his research were published in a book called A Passport to Mogonia. And in this book, he makes comparisons between the elementals and occupant reports. Now, Jacques Vallée is very non-committal about all this. But another writer who has been quite in evidence in Fly Source Review during the last 3 years or so, he did commit himself. This was John Keel. Now, I do know that it is quite true that John Keel conducted very widespread investigations on the ground. He saw that this was necessary. He is a journalist with strict journalistic training, and as no one was prepared to finance this, he got on with the job himself. As a result, he lives in New York City, and New York City is a frightful place to live in, I'm told, a place of roaring inflation, and we know what that means now too. As a result of all this, John Keel has made himself virtually penniless. And by the way, he's disappeared more or less from the scene in the recent months, simply because he had to try and earn a living. Well, Keel was a journalist, a hard-bitten journalist, and he was used to looking at subjects that he chose to write about in an objective manner. And I don't doubt for a moment that his investigations were made in a very objective way. However, it also seems, from those of us who've read a lot of Keel's work, that he became hooked on the subject. Keel always said that once he got to grips with one case, started his investigations in West Virginia and Ohio, once he got to grips with one case, it always led to another, and that to another, and that to another. In the end, one case that he investigated would lead perhaps to 40 or 50 other instances, all of them unknown Never been reported by anybody. He calls them his silent contactees. It became a cascade in the end. It not only had UFOs and occupants and contacts, we also had a weird creature called the Mothman, Men in Black, and the lot. Well, broadly, Keel says that all this is due to the elementals. Entities who can materialize in our world in diverse forms and sizes, MIB, Men in Black, mystery animals, and so on. Big weakness of Keel, of course, that as a hard-bitten journalist, he seeks to protect his sources from all the other hard-bitten shark journalists who are sort of floating all around him in his field. Consequently, his work is somewhat badly documented. In fact, some of it is not documented at all. Lots of people can't stand him for this, and one of them in particular is Valet. And yet in Passport to Magonia, Valet implies much the same thing as Keel claims. Very odd world. And by the way, there's a note down here. You'll have to excuse me constantly looking at these notes, because as I say, I haven't been very well and I've only just prepared all this lot. There's a note down here which says Fred, and for a moment I looked at it and thought, the devil's Fred. And I realised that this is a scientist in America who's a very close friend of Dr. Hynek. And in the last year, this chap has been getting abroad and getting out into the country and doing a lot of investigation of his own accounts. In particular, one of the things that he has been very interested in is the case of Snippy, the horse. The horse which was found terribly mutilated, in fact, almost beyond recognition, after alleged UFO landings. Well, one of the things that Fred has said to us is that once he got into this case, it led to others, and the others, that those to other cases, and so on. In the end, he had something like 45 cases in his notebook, just from investigating Snippy. And not one of them had ever been reported anywhere. And some of them are most weird. And this is from a man...
A very important scientist.
A very important scientist. I can't disclose his name at the moment because he doesn't want any publicity. But he is a man of the... Well, he'll soon be a man of world renown, I can assure you. Well, surely enough, lots of these things that we've had reported, and remember, we're just looking at reports. We're not believing any of them. This is a thing we must not do. We must not believe. We must not believe in flying saucers. Get that into your noddles. We must not believe in them. What we must believe is that there is a very real case to examine. And a lot of these things we read about are rather frightening. ABB itself, for all the interest, is quite a frightening thing. Then there's the Itaipu Fault case. I don't know if any of you remember that. A case where two sentries were on duty at a drowsy old Brazilian coastal fort, standing at the top of the ramparts or whatever it is they had with big guns, middle of the night, practically on the verge possibly dozing off, I don't know, but suddenly they see a star. And this star attracts them because it's very bright, very much brighter than all the other stars, and they realise too that this star is approaching them. And then they realise, they think, that this is an aeroplane. And the thing comes closer and they can see that it's not an aeroplane. And in the end, they're absolutely spellbound. Their Thompson guns hang loosely at their sides, and they look at this thing as it's there above them, and then it comes edging down towards them. Now, there was no talk in that report of rays or anything like this, but just of heat. And they became unbearably hot. One of them passed out, and the other one managed to stagger away and try and get some shelter under one of the guns. And he set up a great screaming and a caterwauling and awakened the rest of the camp, the garrison. and they came running up. God knows what sort of enemy was attacking them. Great alarm, all bells clanging, and then everything happened. The bells stopped, the clocks all stopped at that same precise moment. The place was plunged into darkness. And the others from inside got on top of the ramparts just in time to see this bluish light thing going into the distance. There was one sentry stretched out, unconscious, and the other one gibbering like a madman under one of the guns. As far as my information goes, this was when 1957, I believe. This poor devil is still gibbering like a madman. And they were terribly burned. And what's more, they were burned beneath their protective clothing and not in places that were exposed. Then there were the Venezuelan cases. I forget the exact names of the places offhand, but they're all listed. This is the trouble with this subject. There's so many thousands of things there, you just can't remember them all. But I believe one of the names of the witnesses was Gomez or something, wasn't it? They were attacked by an object which came down, and they were attacked by, allegedly, by little hairy dwarf creatures with solid gnarled sort of skins. And they had to put up a terrible fight to get away from them. Well, that looked very stupid, very peculiar, until we had a story which came to us from a very learned anthropologist who'd been studying folklore and goodness knows what else in Mexico. And he told the story of the Icaus. I dare say plenty of you remember these things, which spelt in a most peculiar way with a question mark in front of it. Mexican elemental creatures. And by his description, they were entirely similar to these horrid things which had attacked these gentlemen in Venezuela. Then we had the Flatwoods Monster. By the description of him, looks so much like John Keel's Mothman. And the Sandling Park creature in this country. The four young people who saw an object descending from the sky, an ovaloid shining object, which came down, and they stood and gaped at it, and it stopped just above the ground, a short distance away from them, and then they felt frightened, and they started to run, and looked up, and the thing was keeping pace with them at the same distance. And then it disappeared behind some trees, and they stopped to look. The next thing, as though out of nowhere, there was a monster shambling towards them. A thing which looked just like this Flatwoods thing, and rather similar to the descriptions we've seen of Mothman. Webbed feet, apparently with glowing eyes, apparently, though, as I say, in its shoulders, no head, and winged. They ran for their lives, and who can blame them? Then there was that case, Pilar de Goyas, which we wrote about a couple of years ago. Dear old Ignacio Souza, the fazenda manager and his wife in Brazil, who used to traipse off some 10, 20 kilometres on foot to go and get the provisions and come back with them. And when they got back to the fazenda after one of these long walks, all loaded up with things, there on the fazenda's airfield, these fazenda owners are very wealthy, they invariably have two or three aircraft each, there on the airstrip were three apparently naked, but the wife says no, they weren't naked, they were dressed in tight fitting clothes, creatures gambling about. And they stopped and looked at this lot, and then old Ignacio saw the object. They hadn't seen it at first. That was hovering some way back, just over the runway. And he became very frightened at this point. And he had his carbine with him. He lifted up and started to take a pot shot at one of these gambling entities. And at the moment that he fires, so the story goes, remember his wife was there as well, a thin beam of green light shot out from the thing and glanced off his head and shoulders and knocked him to the ground. The wife, who was a bit alarmed by all this, had the sense to look up, and she saw, because she's probably frightened of these entities and what they might be doing, had the good sense to look up and saw that they apparently disappeared into the thing. We're not told how, I'd be very interested to know that, which then took off and went away. Well, they got her husband home, and in the next 2 days he became very nastily ill. So ill, in fact, that the fazenda owner took him himself in his plane to a nearby town and got him treatment. Well, almost enough of that story, except from the fact that Ignacio Souza, who was capable every week of doing 20-mile walks, loaded up with luggage and goods and provisions and things like this, died inside a few weeks, about 6 or 7 weeks, I believe, of a galloping leukemia. I don't say that it was caused by what hit him, but it could be, or could have been. Now, all these nasty tales, and many others like them, seem a very long way from dear old George Adamski and his good-natured, long-haired bringers of good tidings. Mm-hmm. One of our main disputes with John Keel, who's had a very good airing in Flying Saucer Review, is that he, in his ideas, in his theories that he's put forward, only sees the bad side of things. He thinks the whole, every aspect of this flying saucer phenomenon is evil. However, we all feel that evil must be counterbalanced by good. Human beings need hope. We feel, in fact we know, that there is hope and good in the universe. I mean, apart from the stories that you see of the, or hear of the contactees, there are many stories of healings. You probably remember the story of deputies Good and McCoy, the police officer Good, who'd had his hand bitten by a playful alligator. There was a vogue for keeping alligators at one time in America, until they got too big and then they put them down the loo. And with the result that enormous alligators were growing in all the sewers. And it became a hazard of the evil order for workers to go down in the sewers. Well, Deputy Good was one of these men whose son kept a pet alligator, and it bit him. And he went out that evening with his hand all badly swollen in a nasty mess, all bandaged up. He still went on duty, he was a patrolman, and resting his hand on the side of the car while he was driving, remember, left-hand drive, and they saw this thing, and they were a bit puzzled by it, and then they got frightened by it and reversed the car quickly and started nipping back to this town in Texas, Damon, I think it's called, in Texas. And as they did so, a beam of light is alleged to have shot out from this object onto the car, and in particular, it fell on the hand of Deputy Good. Well, the thing did not keep up this car, which went away, we are told, at speed in excess of 100 miles an hour. And then the coppers began to see that perhaps this is rather a stupid way for cops to behave. So they turned back, and bravely went back again into the fray. And it was during this return that Deputy Good suddenly realised that his hand wasn't aching anymore. But despite this realisation that something peculiar had happened, which possibly made his hand better, when they saw the thing again coming for them, they again reversed and went out of it as quick as they could. His hand was healed within 2 or 3 hours of this very nasty alligator bite. And there are other cases like this where we have reports of people being healed, many of them. The case of our Dr. X in his town in the south of France. Dr. X, I might add, because Amy Michel and Pierre Guérin are still keeping in touch with this case, following it up, and they don't want it to be interfered with. Pierre Guérin sent us some beautiful photographs of the district, and I published them. No one seemed to think there was anything wrong in that, but of course now Dr. X has been discovered by one or two people. But Dr. X also was a man who, his story is in UFO Percipients, had been badly wounded in Algeria, an occipital wound, occipital region of the head, which had caused him a sort of mild paralysis down the right-hand side, with the result that he couldn't engage in his pianoforte playing, which was one of his greatest delights. That, I believe, was in 1958 or thereabouts. Still, he carried on working, and in his house, one day he was working in the garden, and he was trying to uproot a boxwood tree stump, and I suppose he was getting a bit annoyed with it and had a good slash at it with his axe, missed the tree and slashed his shin, which didn't help either. And then a couple of days later, he was awakened by his baby son, who knew that something odd was going on outside, and called out. And the upshot of it was that the doctor eventually went outside and saw this peculiar thing out there. And it approached and shone a beam of light on him. That was all. And then it went away. It's all rather pointless, it seems. But within minutes, Dr. X was back upstairs in his bedroom, had awakened his wife and was telling her all about this thing, and suddenly said, "Tajan, your leg." Here was this doctor who'd been sort of hobbling around like this on crutches. He was striding up and down the room, waving his hands, telling her all about this thing that had happened to him. And suddenly he realised what he was doing with his arm. Well, that's cutting the story very short, but within days he was able to play the piano again. Well, this all sounds nice and friendly, doesn't it? But not all nasty by the sound of it. Except that we know a little bit more about Dr. X, which we hope soon that you will know about. And that's not so nice. Funnily enough, we have a new case from the United States. We're going to tell you about it in the next issue of the review. Not this one that's just come out, but the one following. This is another one of these gentlemen who prefer to remain anonymous, and I can assure you that when you read it, you'll see why. Mr. O, I believe, if I remember correctly. Such a long while since I saw it, the printer's had it for months. Mr. O had a UFO experience, and he developed a partial temporary paralysis. Now, this is a case which has been studied in very great detail by our very good friend, Dr. Bert Schwartz. And Bert says that he had partial temporary paralysis, but he also had peculiar medical terms, lesions, in an unmentionable place, longitudinal stripes. On good authority, there were no stars with stripes. As I say, in our next. Anyway, here's a case I've got here which could retrieve a modicum of hope for the dear old Adamski followers. The E.T. boys were despised by all the other E.T. boys. It's a very peculiar subject, this. Excuse me while I just dig in here, won't you? I thought I'd put the thing in here. Yes, it is. This happened at a place called Lagoa Negra. I think that pronunciation is fairly correct. It means the Black Lake. It took place in the early part of January 1968. A clear night with no wind, somewhere between the times 8 and 10 p.m. So this was at one of these fazendas, which means plantation. in the municipality of Imau, near Lagoa de Patos, you must excuse my horrible pronunciation, which is in the southern Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul. There were five witnesses to this incident. The owner of the fazenda, his wife, his son, his daughter, and the fazenda manager. All persons with reasonable education, and the son and the son's daughter, in fact, have high school education. They saw an object for a period of about 20 minutes. Unfortunately, this isn't in as great detail as I would like, but we have to put up with that. We're very thankful that people send us anything at all. The UFO was round, approximately 3 meters high and 10 meters wide. On the upper part, it had a round, hat-shaped cupola. On the under portion, there seemed to be some sort of protuberance, although they were unable to establish exactly what this was like. This craft or object had a metallic gleam and emitted a powerful cold reddish light. It remained floating at about 2 meters above the ground. There was no rotary movement except when it began to move away. And when the witnesses did observe what seemed to be a slight rotary movement, the reddish light emitted by the UFO made their eyes burn. This is a feature we see many times, burning eyes. We saw this in the Mothman case, we've seen it in many cases. It penetrated through the chinks in the windows and the doors of the house, spreading out inside and lighting up the whole interior. The object was exactly 390 meters from the house, they measured at the time. Now there were five occupants of this thing to appear. The first two were tall, about 2 meters. That's well over 6 feet. They were dressed in a sort of white overall with a broad band and also white at the waist. The collars of the overalls were high and of a dark colouring. The faces of the beings were full and they had long hair hanging down as far as the shoulders. The daughter said they looked like saints. They seemed to be of the white race. They had big, bare feet and long hands and a rigid manner of walking without bending the legs. The three following beings were small of stature, about 1.40 meters, and they were wearing chestnut brown-coloured overalls with a band of the same colour at the waist. They had long hair falling down to as far as the shoulders, and they were also of the white race. Their feet were shod in small boots. They walked rapidly, never, however, quitting the area beneath the hovering disc. The three small ones never moved away from the disc. The two large ones did move away and went towards the wire fence, getting as far as a rampart which runs along beside the fence and serves to drain off water. They followed this rampart along until they were at a point halfway between the disc and the gate. And then they retraced their steps the way they had come. They came away from the disc a second time, this time by another route, that is to say, directly up to the gate, where they halted in front of a small wooden bridge over the rampart. Then they returned to the disc by the same route. Then they came from the disc a third time, this time by a route they had first followed. Crossed the bridge, came to the gate, opened the gate, entered, and then closed the gate. Very polite. And came up to the house. The fazenda owner and his manager had gone out of the house and had taken up positions lying under two palm trees. As there was a small elevation in the terrain between the palm trees and the disc, they were able to observe the object without being seen themselves. The wife and the young son and daughter were inside the house. Frightened by the red light that had invaded the house, the boy was lying in bed, covered himself with bedclothes. The mother and daughter were peeping through the partly open door, watching the entity's approach. Five dogs of the household, which are normally savage towards strangers, never at any moment were disturbed. They remained quiet even when the 2 meter tall beings entered the gate and started towards the house. Seeing that the dogs were not reacting, the manager decided, as he was armed, that he would challenge the entities. But the owner was frightened and ordered him to keep quiet. When the beings got to about 60 meters from the house, the daughter was able to see their features clearly, because the whole area around about was completely lit by the light from the disc. And she exclaimed, "Mother, they look like saints." This explanation by the daughter frightened the mother, who forthwith decided to call her husband to come back to the house. And when she opened the door and called out to her husband, the beings halted. They did this several times until finally they turned round and went back to the disc along the same route by which they had come. Then all of them entered the object, which rose up vertically, apparently with the slight rotary movement. And so on. Nice drawings and everything with it. Well, that all seems very nice and friendly, and as I said, very polite. How long are we normally going? Well, now remember, this is only theorising, the thing we mustn't really do. I've heard it suggested by some people that we human observers are not all we think we are, that we're pawns in some gigantic struggle. It has been said that we're descendants of extraterrestrials set down by godlike extraterrestrial bosses. And there are many, I know, you've read them, who search for evidence in ancient books like the Bible. And they may well assent to that. When our descendants, according to this idea, were set down, they found the planet already occupied by elementals. The elementals object to this. But, according to these ideas, we have been protected by the ET bosses. Is this not familiar to all of us under another name? The phenomena we witness, UFO phenomena, psychic phenomena, et al., are all part, suggested, of the struggle for possession of us. And that is going on all around us. Good extraterrestrials on one side, demoniacal elemental forces on the other, trying to gain control. Once said to me, why are so many of these objects seen? And remember, this is mostly a nocturnal phenomenon. Why are they seen hovering over houses in the middle of the night? What are they doing there? What are they up to, indeed? It looks, by the way, that whatever controls this phenomenon is doing quite a bit of hoaxing and letting down. No doubt a lot of you have heard of Dino Craspedon, who wrote a book when 1957 I believe it was, and this book was considered by most people with some scientific education to be a load of old rubbish. There are others who think it's a very profound book. Now, goodness knows how Dino Craspedon got hold of this, but after this book was published, he went to ground. He wasn't heard of for years. And then suddenly he popped up again. His name, by the way, proper name is Aladino Felix. He popped up again in Rio de Janeiro, and apparently, he's had more contact with the flying saucers. This was the name of his original book. And he says that he has, from them, prophecies. And he made some of his prophecies. And a few people remembered these prophecies. Most of them laughed. And then, when these things came true, they perked up their ears. And he made some more prophecies. And when these came true, people began to take notice. And then he made one prophecy that there would be one nasty natural disaster near Rio de Janeiro in about a month's time. And indeed, in about a month's time, it rained and it rained and it rained and it rained. And my goodness, it's heavy rain there, I'm told. So heavy that all down the sides of the morros, which overhang and down which these villages and houses are built, these shanty towns, it poured a deluge of water and mud, and it wiped out hundreds of people. Dino Craspedon became news. In fact, big news. They got him on the television, and they got him prophesying on the television. And he prophesied. And it's all on the record in the papers. He prophesied that Martin Luther King would be assassinated, and also Robert Kennedy. And when he'd done this, and they were indeed assassinated, then people were very, very interested. And then Dino Craspedon began to prophesy that there would be a great wave of violence. Where was he getting all this information from? There would be a great wave of violence, robberies, murder, looting, rape, and goodness knows what, by great gangs of robbers. And all this, in due course, started to take place in about a month's time. But Dino Craspedon had indeed been so successful in his previous prophecies that the police had taken very real notes and were laying in wait for this to happen. And the gang was quickly captured and rounded up. And one of the leaders of the gang was Dino Craspedon. And when they took him away to prison, the UFO entities told me, the men from Venus told me, they will come and rescue me. That was 2 or 3 years ago, and he's still in prison. So you see, it's possible that indeed Dino Craspedon was getting his information from some inspired source. I mean, you can't do that sort of thing time and again. You can do it once, but not several times running. And then there came the letdown, and of course the letdown of the flying saucer subject with it. Well, you probably all know that it's far more to my taste to say, how is the game being played and by whom? And in the humanoids, I don't like to keep rubbing this down your throats, but in the humanoids in 1966 we began to make some manner of suggestions, little ideas which came creeping in. This idea, you so often see reports of these objects landing and then people suddenly seeing things, and suddenly these things going away, these things suddenly appearing as if down beams of light. What if something is being projected from solid objects indeed, which are coming here and landing or near landing here, projected into the minds of people? I thought about this, and then I spoke to Maxwell Cade about it, and it wasn't until we had spoken together on this that I decided I would put these things, make these things public, these ideas. Max Cade said that it was very reasonable to think that human beings could have fears when they saw an object landing. What is it? What is in it? Is it a hairy monster? Does it contain a hairy monster? Now, Max is a very gifted hypnotist, among many other things. And he knows what can be done in this field. And he says that it's quite possible that these ideas could be picked up, amplified by something, and thrown straight back to the person who is thinking them or having them or experiencing them. And back come these ideas, greatly amplified. Indeed, is it a hairy monster? And woof, there is a great big hairy monster. This is not so silly as it sounds. something on this principle is used by us in our defense radar systems. We pick up the incoming quotes, enemy quotes off radars, amplify them, distort them, and send them back. So they get the wrong end of the stick. I know for a fact that it was done. We were doing things like this in 1944, 1945. They called it then. It was quite simple by comparison. I did do a bit of work on radar. And 1944 and 45, we had a thing called spoof, which was indeed attempting to spoof the enemy intelligence by apparent indiscriminate use, very cleverly done, indiscriminate use of the radio networks. Max says this thing could possibly be done in the field of hypnotism. I'm not going to argue with him. I've seen what he can do with hypnotism. I've told you about the Sandling Park thing. Do you remember the Whidbey Island case? This Whidbey Island thing was just about the first case I ever dealt with as editor of the Review. Very peculiar, not terribly conclusive, but, well, as I say, we must collect lots and lots of these things, and then they all begin to fit, the pattern begins to emerge. In the Whidbey Island case, the woman saw this object hovering outside her yard, and the entity came down, which, so she said, had some sort of conversation with her. In what manner, we don't know. The point is that the entity just came straight through the side of the craft, and indeed it went back that way. And this sort of thing happened apparently at Belo Horizonte in Brazil, where the small boys in the backyard of their house saw the thing hovering, and they saw the one-eyed man come out of the side of the craft, come right through it and down the beam of light towards them, the stiff gait. Then there's the case of Oscar Iriart in Argentina. There are hundreds of these cases, but I don't have time to just recall one or two. Oscar Iriart, who was out riding, and he saw this peculiar object, and he saw two men. He thought they were bird fanciers or something. And then when he got close, it was rather peculiar the way these looked at him. When he got close, he realized he could see right through their legs. It's a rather peculiar thing, isn't it? Then at Mendoza, the two casino chappies, they were driving home in their old banger when it was stopped. They saw this object hovering over a sort of old broken down bit of ground, the side of the road, and the beam of light from it. When their car stopped, they got out, they wondered what the hell was going on, and they saw five entities, they said. Everybody said they were mad. They saw five entities which came towards them across the ditch as though there were a bridge there, as along a beam of light. I wonder if there's anything in this idea of images being projected into the minds of the observers. Certainly worth thinking about. Anyway, the message in all this is this idea of what's been happening in the last 10 years is that we must not discard any ideas or evidence out of hand. The extraterrestrial hypothesis is still very valid, albeit more sophisticated than heretofore. And we mustn't forget Adamski any more than we must forget AVB, Dr. X, and Uncle Tom Cobley and all, and poor Ignacio Sousa. It's not inconceivable that entities control devices whereby the images of these creatures appear to us, and messages I put that in quotes, in messages, in the mind. For what purpose, we don't know. Maybe the purpose is to make the subject look silly, or maybe to let the other side look silly. Who knows? And even notions of nocturnal sexual orgies in flying saucers can be pumped into human minds. It's possible that these same entities are responsible for other phenomena too. Therefore, we must look at everything and be completely open-minded. That's the message, how I see it. We must collect everything and record it. We've made a venture which has not come unstuck, but it's been severely hampered by these recent postal shenanigans of our little case histories, a new magazine. This is all to provide extra space so that this subject can be recorded, even if only for posterity. I'd like to finish by saying how much better it would be for us if we had properly documented records of all the events of 1947, or 1946, or 1909, or even 1897. We might even find it superfluous to hypothesize. Thank you very much.